Derek Jensen, welcome back to Extinction Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to be sitting here with you. In addition to the over 24 books that you've written and the many videos and audios that you've been involved in, you also host your own resistance radio show on PRN.FM. How did that get started?
I'd been a guest on a few programs, and then they asked me to do a program, and you know, I've done interviews for a long time. That's a form that comes pretty easily to me, and in fact, one of my first books was a collection of interviews. I've got several collections of interviews out, and the first thing I ever published was an interview with Joseph Campbell when I was 22 or 23, and so it's always been a pretty a pretty straightforward form for me. And so they asked me to do a radio program, and I knew that I didn't want to do the sort of program that, I mean, I hesitated for quite a while because I've seen some radio or listened to some radio programs, and I've heard about radio programs like Rush Limbaugh or something. And the last thing that I wanted to do was to be another middle-aged white guy bloviating on the events of the day. That just didn't interest me. And so it took probably 3 or 4 months for the idea to occur to me that instead of it being me talking, it should be me listening. And then I agreed to it very quickly once I realized that I could do one where I just interview other people and the focus is on them and the issues. And so since then, it's developed into what I wish that serious... I'm not a journalist, but it's what I wish serious journalism was, and what your work is, which is an in-depth exploration of some of the most important ideas of our time. I mean, I was just interviewing somebody not very long ago who was talking about one of the effects of the internet on our ability to do long-form thinking, that the internet is biochemically harming our ability to carry long thoughts. I mean, we already had entered soundbite culture, and it's gotten far, far worse, such that, you know, what is it, how many characters are in a tweet, 140 or 132 or some very small number of characters, and you're supposed to be able to condense ideas into that, and that's even worse, once again, than soundbite culture. So what I'm trying to do with this is to take 45 to 50 minutes every week to talk about some important issue, and one of the things, I mean, there's... I talk about, you know, women, I talk with women who are fighting pornography and women who are fighting prostitution and trafficking in women. I talked to a woman recently about how they are harvesting eggs from girls in Africa to use in research and for surrogacy, and how incredibly exploitative that is. And so I think it's really important to talk about those issues. And then in addition, you know, I always come back to the natural world, and one of the things I'm trying to do is finding various classes or beings who are being wiped out, and then focusing and talking to someone who is focusing on that issue. For example, freshwater mussels in North America have gotten completely hammered in the last 200 years. Nobody talks about this. And so I talked to somebody who's working to save them. And the Great Lakes are hammered. And so I talked to somebody about that. And there are the most endangered cetacean is the vaquita. It's a small relative of dolphins and whales and porpoises, lives down in the Gulf of Baja. And there's less than 100 of them. And I've talked to people about prairie dogs. Tomorrow I'm interviewing somebody about plastic in the oceans. So I'm trying to focus on these different issues and have and take them. When I ask to interview somebody about the natural world, the question I always ask them first is, are you biocentric? Because I'm not really interested in how the Colorado River is going to be used for irrigation in Arizona. If somebody wants to talk about that, they can talk about that on mainstream news. I'm really interested in the Colorado River's perspective. It's like I was going to interview somebody about sturgeon soon, and they do some good work on it, but then they said they really wanted to talk about, you know, basically how the sturgeon affects the town, the community where they live, the human community. It's like, those have lots of voices, and what I'm really trying to do is to give a voice to those who don't have a voice in this culture. Anyway, so that's what the radio program's about.
Yeah, you have done an excellent cross-cut bringing forward that voice for those who don't have one.
Thanks.
And particularly the gal who spoke about the harvesting of the female human eggs. It was really hard to listen to that program, and yet I couldn't leave it. And I went back. I've listened to it 3 times because it is just devastating. But
you know, that's
one out of many.
It's interesting that you are not the only person who has written to me. I thought the interview was really interesting, and it's a horrifying subject.
Truly horrifying.
And you are, I think, one of 3 or 4 people who has written to me specifically to say how devastating that interview was. So you're not alone in being completely, you know, what's the Canadian or UK term, gobsmacked by that.
Yeah. And, of course, all of these interviews are in your archives.
Yeah.
Anybody can go back and find it. Her Lael was, I believe, her last name. Just for anybody out there.
Oh, Jennifer Lal.
Jennifer Lal, yes. That was at the end of November. And you're also, of course, in addition to, you know, this amazing radio program that you produce, an author of many books. You have a new one that's coming out in the spring, The Myth of Human Supremacy. Do you want to give us any kind of little headlines on that?
Well, I think that human supremacism is the biggest problem facing the world today. And, of course, all supremacisms they're all tied in. And human supremacism specifically is the notion that humans are separate from and superior to everybody else. And it really, you know, in my book Dreams, I quoted Richard Dawkins as saying that the way we know science is true is that, he says, science bases its claims to truth on its spectacular ability to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command and to predict what will happen and when. And the point is that, that's true in a sense, that we're sitting here in this room and there are lights on, and when you flip a switch, the lights go on or off. So that's true. But on another level, he's done something extraordinarily sneaky and dreadful, which is he has conflated domination with how we know something's true by making matter and energy jump through hoops on command. How we know that something is true is by its ability to do that. So let's pretend for a second that there's a hoop here and I have a gun and I point the gun at you and I say, on the count of 3, you're going to jump through the hoop or I'm going to shoot you. Well, on the count of 3, you jump through the hoop, and what do you know? I'm a genius because I predicted what would happen and when. But don't you think if I put a gun on you that I'm going to destroy any possibility of friendship between us? And my point is that there are other ways to know. There are ways to know that are not based on domination. He has actually put domination to our epistemology. And in Human Supremacism book, it's even worse because we have, how do we know that humans are superior? Well, first off, there's the main arguments that we hear all the time. Humans are superior because we are more intelligent. Well, how do we know more intelligent? At one point in the book, I talk about this, they're all self-defined, and they are things that humans do. So we're defining things that humans do as making it so humans aren't superior. And that's really tautological. It's tautological, using a thing to define itself. So, and it also doesn't work, but they'll say, okay, humans are superior because, you know, we have big brains. We hear about that all the time. You know, big brains are what sets humans apart. Well, I got bad news, which is human brains are about, what is it, about 5 pounds or something? And walrus brains, 4 pounds. Walrus brains are slightly smaller. Elephant brains are bigger. Whale brains are bigger. And they say, oh, but that doesn't count because what's important is brain size to body mass ratio. Mm-hmm. And like a bad news, the brain size to body mass ratio of humans is about 2.5%, which is about the same as it is for mice. Mice have the same brain size to body mass ratio.
I have suspected this.
Songbirds have about an 8% brain size to body mass ratio. And shrews actually have the biggest, which is 10%. And as soon as you say that, then the human supremacists immediately go, well, brain size to body mass ratio isn't what's important. So as soon as you fulfill one of the categories, then they change the category. It has to be something else. And the other thing is, there's this great list in The Atlantic from a few years ago of some of the greatest inventions of humans. And the list is really interesting because at every step of the way, the inventions that are considered wonderful are all things that have extended one's ability to dominate. Mm. So gunpowder. The cotton gin is listed, which facilitated slavery. Mm-hmm. As opposed to, they don't list things like the local Talawa. The Talawa, who have lived here for at least 12,500 years, the Talawa had salmon welcoming songs. And think about, the point is that it takes an entirely different mindset. Okay, we're going to presume, okay, neither one of us is going to argue that white people are smarter than the Talawa, right?
Right.
But the Talawa did not invent chainsaws and backhoes and refrigerators. And that suggests to me that the creation of chainsaws and backhoes and refrigerators can't be a measure of one's intelligence. And Lewis Mumford talks about this extensively. I love this. He talks about how a piece of technology doesn't arise in a vacuum, that it emerges from and gives rise to a social structure, so that he called that a technic, the T-E-C-H-N-I-C, the mindset that gives rise to and emerges from a technology he calls a technic, the combination. And he talked about how you can have democratic and authoritarian technics. And an authoritarian technic would arise out of an authoritarian mindset. A democratic technic would arise out of a democratic mindset. And it's really easy to tell the difference. That basically, if it is something that I can do myself, like basket weaving would be a democratic technic because no one can monopolize the reeds that you make the baskets from. Anybody can do it. And they can do it better or poorly. That's not the point. The point is that no one can control you with it. On the other hand, and a salmon welcoming song would be a democratic technic because anyone can do it, no one can control you, and you can't use it to control others. On the other hand, the plow would be an authoritarian technic because once you have plow, first off, plowing is really hard work. And it is one of the first forms of slavery. Okay, I'll back up. And a better example would be a bow and arrow is a democratic technic because anybody can make them. On the other hand, guns are an authoritarian technic because they require mining. And I'll back up a second and tell a quick story about this. I was getting interviewed by a guy from Nature magazine a couple years ago. And he said he was a dedicated Marxist who believes that all interactions should be voluntary. And he also believes that you can have cities with entirely democratic authority or democratic decision-making processes. I said, okay, great. In this city, how do you get around? He said, buses. I said, okay, what do you make the buses of? He said, metal. What do you think? I said, okay, where do you get the metal? He said, mines. Okay, so I said, you know, you do recognize that mining is one of the first forms of slavery, too. Nobody goes in a mine and lives their life underground.
Because it's so much fun.
Because it's so much fun.
Yeah.
And he said, well, you just pay them a lot. Like, well, okay. I mean, I don't agree, but we'll give you that. I said, we do recognize that mines are inherently destructive, right? They destroy, like, the rivers nearby. And he agreed with that, but he didn't care because rivers, he only cared about humans. And the point is that I then said, okay, so what about the people who live on this river? What do you do for them for a purely voluntary exchange? He said, well, you pay them to move. I said, what if they don't want to move? He said, you pay them more. I said, what if they have lived here for 5,000 years and their ancestors have lived here and their ancestors are buried there and they will not move? He said, well, how many are there? I said, what difference does that make? I said, okay, let's say there's 500 of them. He said, well, you take a vote. And the people in the city vote that you're going to remove those people on the river. And you just outvote them. I said, do you see what you've done? You've gone from purely voluntary exchanges to democratic empire, genocide, and land theft from the indigenous in less than a minute. All because you need to have metals. And so the point is that smelting metals is not a sign of intelligence. It's a sign of an authoritarian technique. And this gets more problematical because there are some people who argue that intelligence itself is, as Ernst Mayr said, a lethal mutation. And that, and basically the book boils down to, if I had an argument with a human supremacist, the supremacist would say, here's how we know we're so smart, is we made cameras, and we made electric lights, and we made refrigerators. And I would say, well, we're killing the planet. I think that's really stupid. And he would say, well, we made airplanes, and we made TVs, and we made Wi-Fi. And I would say, we're killing the planet. I think that's really stupid. And my point is, what trumps everything? For me, for them, making all of these gadgets trumps the murder of the planet in terms of what determines intelligence. And they are, once again, defining intelligence. I'm going to back up again. Elon Musk is just dreadful. He has said that one of the ways that they should look for intelligent life on other planets is by looking for pollution, because pollution is a necessary side effect of a civilization, and a civilization is based on intelligence. So what he has done is specifically and explicitly conflated polluting your land base with intelligence. And I think that's really stupid.
It's pretty mind-boggling, Derek.
And yeah. What I'm trying to get at with this book is I'm trying to break that, because so long as we, there's this great line that I read somewhere another 20, 30 years ago, which is that unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture.
Could you say that
unquestioned
again?
Assumptions are the real authorities of any culture.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the unquestioned assumption is that humans are superior and it's okay for us to destroy the planet, and if it's, I mean, like one of the solar boosters and the bright greens will argue that biomass is a great renewable source of energy. But biomass is, that's just fancy language for cutting down forests. And if you perceive forests as consisting of living beings whose lives are as valuable to them as yours is to you and mine is to me, then biomass is just another form of genocide. And one of the things I'm attempting to destroy with this book is one of these fundamental unquestioned assumptions of this culture, and this is just as true for scientists as it is for Christians, is a belief in the great chain of being. And the great chain of being is the notion that God is here, and then down below God is angels, and then below angels is the king, and then below the king is, you know, the queen or the dukes. You know, we can, women are always like a couple steps below the men here. Mm-hmm. And then there are, you know, the mass of humans, and then there are primitive, quotes, humans, indigenous people, and then there are animals, and there are plants, and there are, And eventually you make your way down to soil. And there's this hierarchy. And basically it's a hierarchy now. God isn't up here, but pure reason still is. Pure abstract thinking. Science is on top instead of God. And it's all very body-hating, because the body is below the mind. And it's also very nature-hating. It's also completely bogus. You know, scientists may object to me saying that a lot of scientists still buy into this, because evolution is clearly non-hierarchical. But if you ask how they spend their days, is still, as Richard Dawkins says, attempting to make matter and energy jump through hoops on command. So they're still buying into this notion that that there is this hierarchy that has led to all sorts of problems. And it's like, years ago I was friends with Frances Moore LePage, who's a delightful person, by the way. She's wonderful. And one of the things she used to say is that gave her great optimism was that they, at one point, people believed in the divine right of kings. And she said, how did they stop? And she said, they just stopped. At one point, they no longer believed in the divine right of kings. And that gave me great optimism for several years until I started writing this book. And then I realized that the divine right of kings has not gone away. What's happened is it's become the divine right of humans and the divine right of industrial humans. It's merely expanded to include, I mean, basically any human can do anything they want to a tree. I mean, nobody's going to care if you cut down a tree. Nobody's going to care if a river is dammed. They're killing the Mekong River as we speak right now. Mm-hmm. And humans have the right to do that according to the divine right of humans. So I really want to attempt, insofar as possible, to destroy that. And one of the things I do is I keep setting up all these ways that humans say we're superior, and then I show that we're not. I mean, humans are the only ones with language. Bullshit. I mean, there is so much language out there. Plants have... There's this great line by this guy, Cleve Baxter, who said that with the increasing sensitivity of scientific measurement, only for so long will science be able to maintain the facade of human separation. Because nowadays, it ends up, they're doing measurements on these, that plants have vocabularies. This guy doing, Stefano Mancuso in Italy, who is doing, he's making a dictionary of plants communicate to each other with pheromones, with scents, with volatile organic compounds. And he's making a dictionary of those. And his dictionary, I think, is up to, I don't remember, it's like 1,500 or 2,500 words.
But separate chemical
messages
that plants use to communicate
with each other and members of other species.
Specifically with each other, but also other species are able to...
Well, so for example, say some caterpillars come in and start eating on a plant. That plant will send out messages to the others, hey, this species of caterpillar is here, you need to change, because it can't run away. So you need to change the composition of your leaves to make them less edible to these caterpillars. And they will also send out chemical messages to, for example, if there's an infestation of aphids, the plants will send out messages, they will communicate, they will call out for help from ladybugs. And ladybugs will come from miles around to eat the aphids. And there's this woman, Monica Gagliano, who did this experiment with plants. This is really cool. She did this experiment with plants where she took mimosa plants, those sensitive plants, the ones if you touch the leaves, they fold up. Mm-hmm. And they basically fold up to make their surface area smaller and to protect themselves from whatever sort of... It's a startle response, essentially. And what she did is she set up this experiment where she would take the plants, and then she would had a machine that would drop them 6 inches, like every 5 minutes or every certain length. And what she found is that the plants, when they would first drop like that, they would startle and they would close. But then they would soon understand that this actually wasn't a threat. And they would learn, and they would no longer close after... And she said different plants, some plants learn more quickly than others. Some plants would learn very quickly, some plants would take a longer time to learn. And then, of course, scientists were saying, well, this doesn't work because you're just tiring the plants out. But if you touch them, they still close. They learned that this specific stimulus is not a problem. Mm-hmm. And she's had a very hard time getting this published, not because the data is wrong. The data is very clear, but everyone objects to her using the word learn with plants. And mm-hmm. she refuses to take that word out of the paper.
And that is a very good example of a white supremacy mindset.
Yep.
That they would not acknowledge that plants could learn.
Yep, absolutely. And one of the things I do in the book that's pretty fun is I have this section where I'm just riding along and then I stop and I say, you know what, I'm sick of this bullshit. I've been writing about this for 20 years and I'm tired of it. So the truth is, I am actually superior to you. And how do I know I'm superior to you? Well, because I'm the one who decides what makes superiority. And I've decided that superiority means that I've written more than 20 books. And if you write more than 20 books, you're superior to anybody who hasn't. And, well, okay, what about Stephen King? He's written a lot more books than that. Well, it's like, no, my books are better than his because I just keep changing it. And I say, well, so I'm superior because, you know, I got a degree in physics. Well, why aren't you more superior? What about the people who got a PhD in physics as opposed to my bachelor's? Well, I'm superior to them because I was smart enough to get out of physics. You know, it's like, so basically my point is I just do like 5 pages where I'm just, and then at the end of it I say, look, if it's easy to see how offensive and stupid this is, that I make up rules whereby I am determining that I am superior, why is it so different when in the culture at large you have humans declaring themselves to be superior, industrial humans declaring themselves to be superior, white male industrial humans declaring themselves to be superior for all sorts of stupid reasons, and then, we think we're superior because we can dam a river. Well, beavers dam rivers. And something great about beavers, beaver dams are some of the most biodiverse habitat on Earth. And when humans dam rivers, so that they kill them. And so how's it feel to be stupider than a big rodent with big teeth, you know? It's like, that's part of it too, is just recognizing that there is, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, maybe 3 or 4 months ago. He was telling me how sharks, one reason they can swim so fast is because their skin is really rough. If they had smooth skin, they wouldn't be able to, basically having rough skin makes a little turbulent area next to their skin and allows them to, it doesn't matter. It allows them to swim more quickly.
I was going to say it allows them to grab onto the water and move themselves through it.
Well, it's kind of the opposite. What it does is it makes a little lubrication. It makes a small turbulent layer right next to their skin that makes mm-hmm. a lubrication between them and the body of water in general.
Okay.
And this guy himself, he goes to church every week. And I said, so do you believe in a God? And I'm not talking about intelligent design, you know, God that way with Christian God. I said, so do you believe in a God then? And he said, no, I don't actually. You know, I go to church because I go to church. And I said, because here's the thing is, I hear all these amazing things, and I keep thinking, nature is really intelligent. It's extraordinarily intelligent. And he said this great line back to me, which is, time is very intelligent. Mm. And his point was that you can have evolution taking place for millions of years can create great, great, great intelligence. One more thing about this. I was stuck in San Francisco overnight because my flight was late getting into San Francisco, so I had to spend the night before I could fly up. I'm bored, and I'm just thinking, you know, it's wasting time in the hotel room. And I type in a question I'd wondered for a long time, which is, what is snot? And snot, it ends up, is, I thought it was just dead white blood cells or something. It's not. It ends up, the snot is very sugary, and the purpose of snot is you get every time you breathe in, you're bringing in all sorts of bacteria. Some of them want to eat you. And speaking of bacteria, did you know that bacteria can communicate antibiotic resistance? They use a quote universal language among bacteria to communicate, to teach other bacteria how to become antibiotic resistant.
Wow.
Bacteria of other strains.
Wow.
It's extraordinary. And they can do this.
That's amazing, Derek.
And that's the thing is the world itself is so amazing. Snot is amazing. Some bacteria or somebody gets in here. What happens is your body notices it, the mucous membranes are very susceptible to having people, you know, other people come in. And so what you do is you create this, there's these long sugars and sort of this rubbery substance. Basically, your nose is creating, your mucous membranes are creating a treadmill that the bacteria keeps getting stuck in this sticky material and it's trying to fight its way through, and your body keeps creating more and more of it. And it's a brilliant, I mean, if I were designing a body, I couldn't think of all these things. You know, it's just, even something as simple as snot, which also, by the way, the fact that it's all sugary, explains why kids eat their snot.
You know, I thought of that immediately. As soon as you brought that, I'm thinking of all these, yes, that makes sense. So it's a filtration and a removal mechanism all at once.
Yep.
Well, the intelligence of living communities has been trampled on by human beings.
And really that's the question, is who knows better what a forest needs?
Than a forest.
The forest knows what it needs. And it knows far better than I. And the notion that I could manage a forest is completely nuts. And it's so incredibly complex. I love this line by David Ehrenfeld. Nature is not only more complex than we think, it's more complex than we can think.
So at this particular time on the planet, when human endeavor has, when we are so teetering on the brink, we're in the middle of the sixth great extinction, which could take out most life forms on the planet, which thankfully will take humans out, and the planet will, over 250 or 300 million years, perhaps.
Perhaps being the key word.
Perhaps, yes. I often say it could be a radioactive methane fireball, too.
Oh, it could. And even the mainstream news, this has come out in the mainstream news the last few days, that we have been saying this for a long time, that the mainstream news is now acknowledging that the phytoplankton could completely shut down and the world could essentially lose its oxygen.
Right.
Even the mainstream news is acknowledging that.
Yes, this is becoming almost like a common dialogue out there.
And this is one of the things that kills me, too, is even when the mainstream news has been saying for a few years now that the oceans could be devoid of fish, and now they're saying the earth could be devoid of oxygen, and yet I am still considered a nut because I think we should consider bringing down civilization. And we're talking about life on Earth.
Exactly.
I mean, I am by nature, a lot of people won't know this, but I am by nature a very conservative person, by which I don't mean Republican, I don't mean any of that. I mean like the Otto Leopold, that the first rule of tinkering is you don't lose any parts. And I am not a precipitate person, by which I mean I don't make rapid decisions. And it's not like I hate Beethoven's Ninth or Hot Showers. It's that it seems to me really immoral and stupid to kill the planet. And I think that when we're talking about life on the planet, I mean, the whole thing, like all this bright green stuff, all this maintaining civilization, it breaks down very easily for me. It's also because I have empathy. And because I love life, that it all breaks down very simply. In terms of global warming, do you think that if whales, not the country, but the beings, do you think that if they were at the table in Paris, that they would be suggesting solar panels as a solution to global warming? What about Delta smelt? What about coho salmon? What about phytoplankton? What about traditional indigenous people still living in traditional ways? What they would suggest is that this madness needs to stop completely, not try to extend it. Here's one of the problems, is that environmentalism has, over the past 25, 30 years, longer than that, but has, over the past few decades, stopped being about trying to save wild places and wild beings and become about sustaining this culture. And that's completely nuts. It's a terrible, terrible, terrible thing. And this is, it's extraordinary that you can get 100,000 people marching in some city, and if you ask them why they're marching, they will say, I'm marching to save the planet. But if you ask them what their demands are that they want subsidies for a sector of the industrial economy, solar or wind. That is an extraordinary PR coup. And it has nothing. It has fuck all to saving salmon. And I mentioned early on that, or maybe before the tape was running, that that I can't stand Lester Brown. And one of the reasons I can't stand Lester Brown is because he has been very explicit, and so many of them have, but what they're trying to save is civilization, which is what is killing the planet. It seems to me, I mean, what do all the so-called solutions to global warming have in common? What they all have in common is they all take industrial civilization as a given, and the natural world is having to conform to that. And that's nuts.
Well, it's completely flipped around, and it's suicide.
It's suicide. And actually, I don't care if it's suicide. It's
It's ecocide, exactly.
It's
I would like to see the humans go away and leave the rest of the living beings, but it doesn't work that way.
If we're going to behave this way, yeah, absolutely. And there's this line that suddenly came to me from the book The Body by Stephen King. It was the short story or the novella on which Stand By Me was based. And there's a line, one of the characters, it's a dreadful line, but the line was, go out in car wrecks. Go out alone and you're a hero. Take out somebody else and you're dog piss. And it was really sort of a masculinist, you know, yeah, I'm supposed to drive fast, you know, die young and leave a nice looking body or something like that. So it's kind of stupid on that level, but that line's always stuck with me that, you know, if humans want to commit suicide, or if, you know, if this pisses me off on a personal level too, or on an individual level, whenever I see some domestic violence person who kills his family and then kills himself, it's like, fuck you. If you want to kill yourself, just kill yourself. I don't care. But don't take your family out first.
And that's precisely, of course, what the human species is doing, is that they're taking their family, the family
yeah,
of
exactly.
other living beings,
exactly.
out.
And the domestic violence thing is not superficial. I mean, the whole dynamic mm-hmm. is very, it's the same. This is an abusive, controlling, violating imperative that is running this whole culture.
And it is so ingrained and insidious, and most people haven't, they really genuinely do not have a clue.
Well, it's in the very nature of our epistemology at this point. That's what I was saying earlier about how we know something's true. And that's the point of the human supremacism book, is we have defined the ability to violate as how we define superiority and how we define humanity. And it's really, really dreadful. How do we ultimately know that we are superior to everybody else? Because we're fucking them and they're not fucking us. Because we're destroying them and they're not destroying us. If they were superior to us, they could destroy us. So we have conflated mm-hmm. superiority with violation, which is a dreadful conflation that I want to absolutely demolish.
Well, I'm very happy to know that you have dedicated another chunk of your life to creating a book that will come out soon. Next spring, 2016, just around the corner. To help those who are interested in reading still to unravel some of this programming. I mean, this is programming that has been perpetrated upon us over many millennia, and the result is not nice. However, for myself, just becoming as aware as possible and decolonizing my heart and mind as much as possible to be as authentically in resonance with living beings that are left is all I can do. Witness and be present. So if your books and this new one help us out here to decolonize our minds from this kind of nonsense, yay.
Well, thanks.
Yeah. We could probably talk for a few hours, but you know, this is great, Derek. Thank you so much for sharing. And The listeners out there can go find you at your website, DerekJensen.org, and your radio program, Resistance Radio, at PRN.fm. Mm-hmm. And the publisher of your new book, Where Can People...
Seven Stories.
Okay. Well, we'll look forward to that.
Thanks.